Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead, we sit down with an asylum seeker who has made his way to Chicago. He tells us about the journey, how he had to leave his family behind, and his hopes for the future. The arrival of thousands of migrants in Chicago in recent months is not unprecedented. We'll look back at the city's history of migration. Recreational marijuana is now legal in both Illinois and Missouri, but is the product more potent than in the past? A university in Illinois is delving into how and when artificial intelligence should be used in the classroom. We'll also mark a centennial for a Mississippi River refuge. And we'll tag along with a deer hunter and learn about the history of canning and why it's making a comeback. Those stories and more this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. We spend a lot of time talking about migrants. Sometimes individual experiences get lost. This week, we hear from Victor. When Victor got to the southern border of the U.S., he says he was given a choice, Denver, New York, or Chicago. Since his arrival in the Midwest, he says he's fallen in love with Chicago, but misses his family and his home country of Venezuela. He's one of more than 35,000 migrants who've arrived in Chicago in the last year and a half. He's now staying at a church. He spoke with Sasha Ann Simons. Victor's pastor, Jonathan Dillao, translated.
Hi, Victor.
Hola.
Welcome to the show.
Gracias.
I would love to learn a little bit more about you, Victor. How would you describe your personality?
Soy un muchacho tranquilo, trabajador.
Yeah, I feel like I'm a calm person. I'm a hard worker, or I like to work. I would appreciate any opportunity where I'm able to do work, any documentation that allows me to do that.
What kind of work do you enjoy doing the most?
Me gusta mucho.
I like construction work and anything that has to do with cleaning.
And when you're not working, what are the things that you like to do? What are your hobbies?
Bueno, me gusta practicar mucho el baloncesto.
I like to play basketball. We go every Thursday. We have a space reserved for us to go Thursday, so I like playing basketball a lot.
I love basketball too. That's my favorite sport. What do you like about the game?
El deporte es muy bueno por de mi parte bueno cuando estuve pequeño de mi infancia.
Yeah, I've always liked it since I was little. I played baseball, but then I switched quickly to basketball. And there was a point in my life where I stopped going to school just to play.
So tell me more about that, your life growing up in Venezuela.
Bueno, yo vengo de una familia muy humilde.
I come from a humble family. My infancy was very, very good during those times.
Why did you leave Venezuela?
Bueno, yo nunca esperaba que Venezuela fuera, mi país fuera sea así como destruida por...
Yeah, I never thought that my country, Venezuela, would be destroyed by the influence of the government there. I had a really good job. I worked in a company that was based off of Mexico, but there was a branch in Venezuela, a food distribution company. It was going really well. We were distributing food to people, and little by little we started seeing that the government was infiltrating or putting a hand on what we were doing. So because of that, we had to stop. The company still exists, but we gave it all for that company.
When you left Venezuela, where did you go?
Estaba con mi familia en Venezuela, ¿cierto? Y me fui a Colombia, emigré a Colombia.
I was with my family in Venezuela, and we just couldn't do it anymore. We couldn't handle it anymore. It forced me out to move to Colombia. I never thought I was going to leave Venezuela, ever. And I waited in Colombia to see if Venezuela would improve, but it just never did.
Was Colombia a better experience? Did things get better for you?
Al principio sí, estuvo un poco mejor, pero ya Colombia...
In the beginning, Colombia worked out for me, but at the presidential election in Colombia, the economy went downhill. There was inflation, and it just made it very, very difficult for us.
Did your children move to Colombia with you?
Sí.
Yes, they moved with me. They're currently in Colombia.
But it sounds like this was a difficult decision. This was... tough for you to leave home, leave Venezuela. You thought things were going to be better in Colombia, and then you were forced to leave again and leave your family behind.
Bueno, es una experiencia que tomé, una decisión que tomé.
Yeah, it was a very difficult decision. When I left my kids, no one really took me seriously that I was coming to the United States. So when it was the goodbye was just like how long is this going to be? And I hoped and trusted that this was going to work out. And, you know, this is why we're here.
Are you in contact with your family right now?
Sí, por supuesto. Incluso el
yes, of course. I still remain in contact with them. Every night I speak to my children and I tell them that I miss them, and they in return tell me that they miss me.
Tell me about your kids. How many do you have, and how old are they?
Tengo dos hijos, uno de 12 años, que es el mayorcito.
I have two children. I have a son who's 12 years old. I have a daughter who's 6 years old, and they are my motor, the reason why I go and do what I do. This is why I'm here. I want to be able to provide for them a good education, a good life, because this is what we keep seeing in our Latin American countries, the difficulty economically.
So tell me about your journey here. What was the experience of crossing the border into the United States?
Bueno, mi travesía empezó en Colombia.
Well, my journey crossing the border started in Colombia, where we crossed the jungle of Darien. And I remember there was a family that they didn't have the appropriate attire to go through the jungle, and they had a child with them, a daughter with them. And I just was remembering my kids, seeing my kids in this young child. And I offered myself to the families because they were struggling. Hey, let me help you. I can help you. Allow me if you. I can help you with this child. And I gained their trust, and they're like, okay, well, you'll be in charge of her while we try to manage ourselves. And he said, yes, I can do it. I will hand her over to you, healthy and secure and safe. And I did. I did when we were able to cross the jungle. I had the daughter, and I gave her to the couple. And to this day, we still remain in contact. And the dad always thanks me for that.
I was watching you as you told me that story, and you took your hand and you put it over your heart. And I could see your demeanor change as you talk more about your children. What was the last thing you heard them say last night when you talked to them?
Estaban muy feliz porque había mucho tiempo cuando estuve en Colombia.
Yeah, I the last time we spoke, I haven't been able to provide for them much for some time, but I was able to collect some money and send it to their mother for them to buy it, just a gift. And I didn't know that they had bought it yet, and so on the call, they said to me, I want to show you something. And they took out the object of the things that were purchased. And they said, thank you so much, Dad. Thank you so much for these gifts. May God continue to bless you while you're over there. And we can't wait to see you back.
So you're here in Chicago. What has it been like since coming to this city?
De lo mejor, porque siempre de niño quería conocer esta ciudad, la ciudad de Michael Jordan.
It's been great because I've always wanted to come to Chicago because of Michael Jordan, and now I'm here. I haven't gone to a game yet, but I would really love to just experience that.
That's a great reason to come to Chicago.
Eso.
Yes.
Michael Jordan's a hero here.
El su majestad.
Your majesty.
So you get to Chicago. What is your living situation like? Where are you sleeping? What shelter were you first placed in?
Bueno, mi experiencia cuando yo entregué a la frontera, nos llevaron a un refugio que.
When I crossed the border, they gave us the option to go to Denver, Chicago, New York. I have a cousin that lives in the suburb of Chicago, and so I said I'm going to go over there, and because we were in contact. On the way over here, he said, hey, you came a little bit too early. I'm not set up to receive you. And I said, well, I'm heading there, and you know, I'll figure it out with God's help. And when I got here, they took me directly to the 25th District Police Station. And there, their accommodations weren't well. There was no showers. And I had to sleep outside. There was no tents. I just had to sleep outside. And I remember that it snowed one time, and thankfully some people that had brought blankets, and I would cover myself. There and until we got to meet Pastor Jonathan, and he allowed us to stay at the church.
When did you meet Pastor Jonathan?
Hace dos meses y medios.
I met him about 2.5 months ago.
So, do you see yourself staying in Chicago or moving elsewhere?
No, me gustó esta ciudad. Me encanta Chicago.
No, I love Chicago. I fell in love with Chicago.
And the hope is that you can bring the family from Colombia.
Sí, por supuesto. Quisiera más adelante.
Yes, of course. As soon as I'm established here, I plan to bring them here in order to give them a better life.
What would you like to see from the government?
Que nos ayudara a apoyar con los permisos.
That the government help us with the paperwork of permits and working, that they don't gift us anything free. We want to be able to work with our own sweat and show our children, our families, what it means to work for your items.
Before I let you go, there are a lot of people from Chicago listening to you right now and listening to your story. What do you think is important for them to know?
Bueno, que yo vine acá es por un mejor futuro para brindar a mis hijos.
I just want, you know, for them to know that I came here so I could provide a better life for my family. Like I mentioned before, all of Latin America is struggling financially. And I really believe that the United States is a land of opportunity.
We've been speaking with Victor, a new arrival here in Chicago, originally from Venezuela. Victor, thank you so much for sharing your story and for spending time with us.
Muchas gracias, también a ustedes.
Thank you as well.
The arrival of asylum seekers in Chicago has led to passionate debates over who the city should be helping and also an outpouring of help. This is not the first time Chicago's seen a large influx of migrants. WBEZ's data reporter Amy Chin and politics reporter Tessa Weinberg talked about it with Mary Dixon.
Amy, you looked at previous periods of migration to Chicago. How do they compare to now?
Yeah, so while we're definitely seeing large numbers of new people coming, it's not unprecedented. We talked to a University of Illinois history professor, Lilia Fernandez, who underscored an important point about today's moment.
Unless you're indigenous native person to this land, then your people came from somewhere else.
So we're all from somewhere else, and so we decided to look at historical census estimates on migration and where people were born going all the way back to 1850. And what we found is that there are actually three periods in the city's history when Chicago saw similar or larger numbers of migrants. And those are early European migration, the Great Migration, and immigration from Mexico in the 1990s and early 2000s.
Tessa, can you explain what was going on during those eras?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the first wave of migration that we really saw started in the mid-1800s. And by that point, most Native Americans had already been forced or pressured to leave the Chicago area. And so the city really transformed after that into a place full of newcomers. Over 100 years ago, nearly half of Chicagoans were born in Europe. And along with that came new ways to aid immigrants, like the famous Hull House on the Near West Side. And then the city also saw a really large increase in Black residents from the South. And throughout the 20th century, hundreds of thousands of Black Southerners moved to Chicago during the Great Migration. And they were escaping racial violence and Jim Crow laws and pursuing jobs. Although when they came to Chicago, there was still a persistent racism that they encountered. And as one researcher put it, you know, the Great Migration was essentially an earlier wave of asylum seekers coming to the city seeking safety and opportunity.
Amy, we see historic parallels to today. What differences stand out to you?
Yeah, so at the time of this kind of third wave of migration from Mexico, there were already several kind of predominantly Mexican-American enclaves like Pilsen that functioned as these ports of entry for new immigrants, where they stayed with family or friends, you know, could speak Spanish in their neighborhood. But today's asylum seekers, they're staying in city shelters because they don't have relatives here. Chicago doesn't have a large existing kind of Venezuelan population. More recently, though, unlike the Ukrainians who've been displaced by Russia's invasion, you know, who've resettled in Chicago through a federal program, the asylum seekers today also don't have that same federal pathway.
Tessa, what lessons could the city learn from its past to apply to this new moment?
Buddy Scarborough, who is a University of North Texas sociology professor, he says this new wave of residents could be a chance for the city to course correct.
Is Chicago and the city itself going to repeat some of the mistakes that it made in the past? Or is it going to set a different foundation that's one rooted in support and investment of new residents of the city?
And, you know, many of those systemic inequalities that previous newcomers face, like segregation and disinvestment, have contributed to population loss in Chicago. And now the city is increasingly becoming one of haves versus have-nots. And Scarborough raises a timeless question about what kind of city Chicago wants to be.
It's WBEZ data reporter Amy Chin and politics reporter Tessa Weinberg. They talked about Chicago's history with migrant arrivals with Mary Dixon. The state of Illinois has announced plans to tear down and rebuild two state prisons, but there is uncertainty, and some are concerned. Lindsay Jones reports.
Governor Pritzker and the Illinois Department of Corrections have announced a plan to tear down and rebuild the Stateville Correctional Center north of Joliet and the Logan Correctional Center in Lincoln. That nearly $1 billion plan still needs legislative approval, but the idea is to address longstanding infrastructure issues. While the state has a plan outlined for the Stateville Correctional Center, details about what will happen in Logan County aren't yet decided. Lincoln Mayor Tracy Welch says he only recently learned of the plan and said the state says it's considering other locations outside of Logan County for when the prison is rebuilt. The correctional center employs more than 450 people.
We'll do our best to keep reaching out. I'm not going to sit by and just wait for them to contact me. We'll keep contacting them, and hopefully they keep us engaged.
Roberta Lynch is the executive director of the state employees union that includes corrections workers. She says the plan as is leaves a lot of questions unanswered. She says the IDOC is already understaffed.
We also do not think employees should be forced to move their families from one end of the state to the other. We also do not want to see employees leave the department and then there is an even more acute understaffing crisis.
The IDOC said in a statement the agency will work alongside various, quote, stakeholders as the plan, particularly for the Logan Correctional Center, develops. I'm Lindsay Jones.
More ahead on Statewide. Stay with us. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Some Northern Illinois University faculty are experimenting with an artificial intelligence or AI tool built to assist them with routine tasks. Peter Medlin has more on how the tool helps spark conversation about how and when it's appropriate for students and their teachers to use AI.
AI anxiety has hit education over the past few years. Many schools and universities have written academic integrity policies addressing student submission of AI-generated work. NIU currently doesn't have a uniform policy. Andrea Guzman is an associate professor of communication at NIU, and she studies human-machine communication and the intersection of AI and communication. And she says the best way to talk about AI is to focus on individual applications, what they can and can't do. Some NIU faculty, like Guzman, are piloting an AI design assistant through their virtual learning platform, Blackboard.
I think a lot of people, when they hear the word AI, they think, oh my gosh, it must be super smart. But, you know, these tools are fairly basic.
Essentially, the tool is meant to help professors streamline tedious tasks. The main way she's used the design assistant is to help create grading rubrics.
Blackboard AI, what it allows me to do is give a description of my grading criteria, and it auto-populates those boxes for me, so I can just go in and tweak. So it probably saves me about like 20 minutes.
So it's not developing the content. It's copying and pasting a format. The tool can also propose test questions based on specific content or generate images for their courses. It is not doing things like grading assignments or writing curriculum. Guzman says that the utility of the assistant really depends on how you teach. Those who teach primarily online often need to use Blackboard more, use a lot of images, and may use the tool more and in different ways. Stephanie Richter with NIU's Center for Innovative Teaching and Learning says the Blackboard Design Assistant was announced and released last summer, and she says the university held faculty focus groups through the fall to talk about how to roll it out on campus, which led to the pilot program starting this winter.
We are asking faculty to experiment with the Design Assistant, to use it in a couple of ways in their courses. They don't have to actually use the materials that the AI produces, but try it out and see what types of material it would produce for them.
The pilot runs through the spring, and faculty can still sign up. Richter says they'll use that feedback to decide if they'll make the AI assistant available to all faculty this fall or summer. And she says the design assistant was built for higher ed.
It also has user agreements and licensing in place. That means that faculty and student work through the design assistant isn't being used to train AI. It isn't being held as corporate property, that what faculty and students are doing in the learning management system remains theirs.
Ben Creed is the president of the Faculty Senate and a professor in the College of Education. He says Richter spoke to the Faculty Senate in January about the AI tool, and some professors had concerns.
Faculty members think there's this need to square the story where how can we rely on a tool that we're asking our students maybe not to use in a similar way.
And even though the university itself doesn't have an AI academic integrity policy, Guzman says that plenty of professors have AI policies in their syllabi.
Mine basically says on my syllabus that it's assignment dependent. And that's because journalism students actually need to know how to use AI in different contexts.
She says transparency about how and when students and professors can use AI is crucial. And Guzman says it brings interesting conversations about what it means to be a professor. What parts of the job should only be done by humans? And what are we comfortable with streamlining? Ben Creed says that's why it's good that there is so much AI expertise on campus to help facilitate those conversations across disciplines. I'm Peter Medlin.
Indiana's governor signed a measure some say could scale back diversity initiatives at that state's colleges and universities. Dozens of civil rights, academic, and even religious groups oppose the plan. Michael Puente spoke with an Indiana University professor emeritus, Russ Skiba, on how the law would impact higher education in that state.
Professor Skiba, you were with the University Alliance for Racial Justice. Groups like yours call the bill racist. What does the legislation seek to do?
Purportedly, it seeks to address something called intellectual diversity, concerns by conservative students that they aren't sufficiently heard on campuses. The term intellectual diversity dates back to conservative movement of the early 2000s. And the latest report of the Indiana Commission on Higher Education on free speech shows that a vast majority, well over three quarters of undergraduate students, believe that there is quite a bit of free speech and that there are no groups that are really being discriminated against in that regard. What the bill is aligned with is according to the Chronicle for Higher Education, are 28 bills that seem to have been pushed out by conservative think tanks at the national level that all are targeting diversity, equity, and inclusion.
Professor Skiba, why is Indiana facing backlash to professors discussing race in their classrooms?
Well, this seems to be a concern. I think you might even call it an obsession with certain elements in the Republican Party. In Indiana 2 years ago, remember, there was House Bill 1134 that was a similar bill targeting K-12 education, that there were limits being put on the ability to talk about race and racism because it made students, quote, uncomfortable. And so anything that made students uncomfortable, would be targeted. That was rejected by, a vast majority of Hoosier citizens, and in fact was turned back 2 years ago and last year. Two versions of that bill were defeated. So this really is essentially the same approach, the same principles being applied to higher education instead. And, there are the same fears. The fears before were that bill would chill discussion about things that our students need to hear about. It is uncomfortable to hear about historical injustice and current racism, but that's a part of the civic education process, is to face that discomfort and work to change things.
Professor Skiba, some say this bill is a move to make universities in Indiana more conservative, attract more right-leaning students and faculty. Do you see this as a push for that?
I can't look into the heads of the people who wrote the bill, but certainly it could have that effect. I've already, and more importantly for me, or equally importantly, is who would be leaving. It's hard to imagine that talented faculty of color and talented students who looked at that bill being in place wouldn't say, well, why wouldn't I go to a state where I won't be reported for speaking about my heritage and history? Why would I go to a state where I'd be living in such a state of fear?
So you can see this effort driving professors and even students of color from considering universities in Indiana and sending them elsewhere.
Absolutely.
Russ Skiba is Professor Emeritus of Psychology at Indiana University in Bloomington. Thank you for joining us, Professor Skiba.
Oh, thanks very much for having me.
We are now in what is known as March Madness. Commentator Beth Howard tells us politicians could learn something by watching how college women basketball players conduct themselves.
I've never been a fan of basketball. I don't like the screech of tennis shoes on the wood floors and the cacophony of whistles and buzzers echoing in the arena. My disdain for basketball has remained fully intact my entire life, until I watched the University of Iowa women play Michigan in the Big Ten semifinal. I was at a friend's house, and she wanted to see the game, and because I love my friend and would do anything to spend time with her, I dutifully parked myself on her couch and proceeded to have my mind blown. These young women, wow, I was in awe. My amazement was not reserved only for Iowa's superstar Caitlin Clark, though she is an excellent role model for her grace and generosity, sharing credit for her success the same way she shares the ball. She beat the men's NCAA record for points scored, yet she's so generous, she also holds a record in the most assists, helping her teammates to score. For these uber-impressive female athletes, it doesn't matter who makes the basket. They are in it together, something you don't see often enough in today's me, me, me society. As they ran, dodged, passed, and pivoted, their tight bond and trust was evident. If someone fell, there was always a hand helping them up, whether the fallen was one of their own players or on the opposing team. What I saw was discipline, strength, poise, resilience, cooperation, and forgiveness. All traits we need more of in the world. Speaking of which, one of the biggest problems in politics these days is that we treat it like a team sport. One side wants to win at any cost, even if it means destroying democracy. It's gotten so bad that instead of congratulating the winning team, some losers incite insurrections. Talk about bad sportsmanship. When Iowa won, the team didn't gloat over its victory, and equally notable, the Michigan women were polite about the loss. In fact, throughout the game, I didn't see any of the bad behavior we see in Washington, D.C. There was no anger, no name-calling, no power-mongering, no obstruction of justice. I loved watching the basketball game. Believe me, no one is as surprised by this as me. So much so that I watched the Big Ten final the next day, going out of my way to drive to a local bar since we don't have television in our house. It was an even more exciting matchup, with Iowa playing another outstanding team, Nebraska, and the game went into overtime. These women, so confident and self-assured, were also fast, running up and down the full court for 2 hours and shooting three-point baskets from well over 25 feet. Talk about girl power. Fans cheered and waved signs in the arena. One of them, a shout-out to Iowa's coach, read, "Lisa Bluter for president," and it made me think, yes, she is what our country needs. A leader who is focused on strategy and success, but remains cool under pressure. Someone who shows composure, good manners, and kindness, even when falling behind in the score. Someone who knows how to get people to work together. A solid team builder. And above all, a woman. Bluter obviously won't be running for president, but in the future, should Caitlin Clark or any of her Hawkeye teammates run for office, I would support them. Because even at their young ages, they display the maturity, problem-solving skills, and unity that could keep our democracy intact. Because what made me finally appreciate basketball, screeching shoes and all, was the pure feminine energy. To quote the late Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, "As society sees what women can do, as women see what women can do, there will be more women out there doing things, and we'll all be better off for it." If I'm a fan of anything, it's seeing women doing things, for the good of the world. Things like young basketball players setting a noble example.
That's commentator Beth Howard, thanks to Tri-State's Public Radio, which produced that segment. The state of Illinois is opening a new facility dedicated to helping Asian American families stay together. Alex Degman reports.
The state's Department of Children and Family Services has announced its first ever Asian American Family Advocacy Center. It'll provide services like crisis intervention, parental counseling, and more, so families can heal and kids can stay with their parents. A DCFS spokesperson says it's important that these services be offered to all families who need them, in languages they understand and in spaces that are culturally relevant to them. The Midwest Asian Health Association is hosting the center at its building on West 26th Street in Chicago. It joins 38 existing family advocacy centers and 9 satellite offices across the state. I'm Alex Dagman.
With recreational marijuana now legal in both Illinois and Missouri, thousands of residents have tried their first legally available cannabis products. But many of those products are stronger than their predecessors. As Zach Perez reports from Missouri, there is a lot more to weed than its strength.
71-year-old Calvin Jacks says he remembers the weed he smoked as a young man being as strong as anything on the market today.
I miss some of the marijuana we used to get. Columbia Red Bud, Gold Bud. You know, and this stuff was wicked.
Jax's memories of the high these wicked strains of weed gave him are probably accurate, but statistically, their strength was nothing compared to modern-day legally and illegally sold cannabis products. While it's difficult to find official sources, by 1995, data recorded by the Drug Enforcement Administration put the average THC content for illegal cannabis products that it had seized at about 4%. 26 years later, that average jumped above 15%. Then by 2017, most flower, that's what they call the actual bud taken from the marijuana plant, that was sold legally for recreational use, had a THC content of between 17 and 28%. That's based on data published by the Missouri State Medical Association. So why is weed getting stronger? Largely because sellers can charge more for it. But former bud tender Joshua Ross worries this growth in strength is leaving some customers out.
We used to have customers come in there all the time asking for something that was a little more dumbed down. You know, you also have to give the patient or customer an option. You know, not to call it diet weed, but sometimes you need to bring it down a notch, you know.
Ross has been working in the cannabis industry for the past 10 years, mainly as a grower and dispensary employee. His current business, called Flavors, recently received a microbusiness wholesale license from the state of Missouri. He says he sees an untapped market in residents looking for low-strength cannabis products, one he plans to address once Flavors is fully up and running next year. Another recipient of a state license, cannabis sommelier Mitch Alexander, agrees there's a need for weaker products. He says that more THC doesn't necessarily mean a user will have a better experience. Consumers and regulators focus on the chemical because it is most responsible for creating the sensation of being high. Alexander believes that THC levels have become a distraction from other benefits of cannabis. He compares people buying weed based on its potency to people buying Everclear to pair with their dinners.
You'd be skipping over all the fine whiskeys, all the fine vodkas, all the fine wines. You would be missing out on an entire array of the best of the best. Because I guarantee you, there's bottles of whiskey that are going to outsell Everclear every single day, even though it's not as potent. So it's really more looking for the entourage effect, the full cannabinoid profile, the full terpene expression versus just focusing on one cannabinoid.
Cannabinoids and terpenes are the chemicals found in the cannabis plant that modify how it affects the body and mind. Alexander's business partner, cannabis cultivator Courtney Bach, hopes that as the cannabis industry expands in Missouri, new consumers will dig deeper into how these chemicals can do more than just get them high.
I would say research what terpenes are, see how different terpenes can help your body in different ways. There's certain terpenes that help anxiety and depression, and then there's certain terpenes that help pain. And then you can base what strain you're going to buy at the dispensary off of that.
Calvin Jacks shares this hope. He says he's known a lot of people who, like him, have been smoking weed their whole lives, but don't understand much more about cannabis than the high that it can provide.
Some of us are using it and happy. Some of us are using it and happy and don't know why. And it's a drug that can be very, very useful if you educate yourself. And just by educating yourself will change your experience. Because now you know what you're feeling, why you're feeling it, and you know what's coming next.
Jack says he now uses three different apps to research the pot he smokes, because, as he puts it, smoking weed is just like anything else. You have to understand what you're doing to get the most out of it. I'm Zach Perez.
We have more to come on Statewide. On the way, we'll visit with a deer hunter. That and more coming up. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. A refuge that was created to protect wetlands, fish, and wildlife on the Mississippi River is celebrating its 100th anniversary this year. Its creation influenced modern environmental movements. Molly Sweeney reports.
In the 1920s, lawmakers and developers proposed plans to drain wetlands across the Mississippi River between Minnesota and Rock Island. In response, the Isaac Walton League, one of the first large conservation groups in the U.S., pressured Congress to protect that part of the river. This led to the creation of the Upper Mississippi River National Wildlife and Fish Refuge. Scott Kovarovics, the executive director of the league, says one of the organization's founders, Will Dilg, had the idea to create a wildlife refuge along the river.
Will Dilg was a big thinker, and he really looked at this and said, well, if we can propose to drain all these wetlands along the river, why don't we propose a national fish and wildlife refuge that would cover and protect the habitat along the river in these states? And this campaign that Will and the League led really transformed our organization to really a leader of a national grassroots conservation movement only 2 years later.
The Isaac Walton League traveled around the country, asking people to contact their representatives and use the media to pressure Congress.
The League, maybe it didn't pioneer every one of those tactics, but it put them together for the first time on a very significant scale. And that's the formula that others used over the successive decades.
And Kovarovic says you can still see the strategies the League used in the 1920s in the environmental movements of today.
And if you fast forward to the modern era of environmental and conservation policymaking, I mean, you see a very similar pattern. Mass movements, the public pressure, the outrage among many Americans that really drove conservation and environmental policy. And so people demanded change, and that's really what I think drove passage in the end.
Today, the Upper Mississippi River Refuge is a group separate from the League. But both organizations work to make sure that hikers, boaters, fishermen, and more are able to enjoy the river.
The Upper Mississippi could look more like the Lower Mississippi. Levees built right to the edge of the water, a couple stories high, straighten it out, you know, as you see in that lower part. And, you know, I think that's what you could see today if it wasn't for this effort.
And the outdoor recreationists who lobbied Congress to establish the refuge also protected the local wildlife we see at the river today.
If you look back to the 1920s, across the country, it was a rarity to see a white-tailed deer or a turkey, a Canada goose, right, driven to the brink of extinction. Today, those wildlife in most places are ubiquitous.
Still, Kovarovic says the river faces environmental challenges like climate change, soil erosion, invasive species, and rising water levels. But he says people could help protect the Mississippi by picking up trash, using less driveway salt, and opting for environmentally friendly fertilizers. And by making their voices heard, just like the League's founders did a century ago. A centennial celebration for the Upper Mississippi River National Wildlife and Fish Refuge will be held in June. I'm Molly Sweeney.
Deer hunting requires some skill along with a bit of luck and a lot of patience, but the pastime is not as popular as it once was. Rich Egger spent a morning with a deer hunter in western Illinois to learn more about the sport.
Mike Folk and I are walking along the edge of a harvested farm field southeast of Macomb. Mike is a maintenance supervisor for Durham School Services, which operates buses for the Macomb School District. But we're not here to talk about school buses just after sunrise on this hazy, damp, and chilly early December day. We're in this open field to bag a deer.
Duck hunting is my main passion, but we hadn't got a deer last year, so I wanted to focus on trying to get a deer this year.
Why is getting a deer important?
The meat. We, you know, it will last us a year or so. So it's that's part's important. Plus, you know, it's a lot cheaper than having to go buy a beef at the grocery store.
We make our way to a hunting blind, which is like a small tent. The camouflage pattern on the blind's exterior helps it blend in with nearby shrubbery and trees. So we start the hunt by sitting. This is a game of patience. And it's a game Mike took up only about a dozen years ago. His first hunting experience came after he married Stephanie, who, full disclosure, is one of my co-workers. She's from a family of hunters, and Mike says the land we're on is owned by one of her uncles.
Lucky enough, I married to a family that hunted, so I never hunted. We had firearms. We was raised with firearms, but we weren't really hunters. I was always target practicing, or paper shooting.
Mike has taken down around half a dozen deer here in the past. He shot his first deer in 2011, the first year he hunted.
And all of a sudden, here comes this buck. He was a smaller buck, but he was my first deer, and I shot him, and he went immediately down. And I think I was so excited, you know, that's kind of what got me hooked too. Plus, doing everything, you know, your adrenaline's pumping. It was just super exciting.
In contrast, this has been a low-key morning. We pass the time looking through the blind's windows while munching on snacks. Mike tells me about another time he was out in the blind.
I actually was sitting here in the middle. I kept hearing this noise outside the blind. And finally, here comes this chipmunk underneath, popped underneath, seeing me, then went running to the other side and went back out. So,
not much meat on a chipmunk, huh?
No. He was having fun, though.
We're set up in an area deer like to pass through, but so far we have not seen any deer, or chipmunks, or much of anything. Then, Mike spots a coyote.
Yep, there's one over there. He's just past the tree line. You see where this thing that's kind of sticks up in the middle between these sets of trees here? He's on the other side of it, the coyote. He's just sitting there. He's out hunting too.
We're out hunting, the coyote is out hunting, but overall, deer hunting is declining in popularity in Illinois. Numbers from the 2022 season show the state had roughly 122,000 firearm deer hunters. A decade ago, that number was 163,000. Dan Stevens hopes to help reverse that trend. He's program manager for the Illinois Learn to Hunt program. It's a collaboration between the Illinois Natural History Survey and the Illinois Department of Natural Resources. He says the program provides an educational pathway for people who are interested in hunting but don't have someone in their immediate family to teach them or just don't know how to get started. Stevens believes hunting is beginning to appeal to millennials who want to provide food for themselves and their families.
Kind of taking grasp of the ownership of that harvest and not just relying on, you know, buying chicken nuggets from the market, but being a part of that local food system.
Stevens says hunting helps manage the state's natural resources. He says every time you buy a hunting license, firearm, ammo, or archery equipment, some of that money goes to conservation programs. And a December 2021 report from the Sportsman's Alliance Foundation says hunting boosts the overall economy nationally. It says recreational hunting and target shooting in the U.S. generated more than $65 billion in combined retail sales in 2020. The report also says spending by hunters and shooters supported nearly 970,000 jobs and created more than $45 billion in wages and income. And for people like Mike Folk and Dan Stevens, hunting puts food on the table. Here is Stevens again.
My wife and I made a decision about 5 or 6 years ago that we wanted to try to move away from factory farmed meat as much as reasonably we could. And so we have basically not had to buy beef since then.
Stevens says they now harvest 2 or 3 deer a year. But for Mike Folk, there are no deer to harvest on this day. The only deer we see the entire morning is a young doe crossing a country road as we drove out to the farm. And, well, the law does not allow hunters to pull over and start blasting away, even out in the country. We leave the blind and walk the field, trying to flush out any deer that might be hunkered down. But no such luck. Still, Mike considers it a morning well spent.
Definitely peaceful.
A little too quiet for what you would like today.
Yeah, I would like a little bit more action, but that's just part of hunting. Sometimes you see them, sometimes you don't, but you got to be out there to get your chance.
He says hunting is an opportunity to get away from screens and get back to the basics.
I think if more people got out to go out in nature, they'd have happier lives.
This was the sixth time Mike headed out during the deer hunting season and the sixth time he had no luck. Yet, he remains optimistic.
Yeah, there's always tomorrow.
And so we pack up the gear in his white 1997 Jeep and head down the gravel driveway, back onto the road and into town, back into the world of screens and stores, and away from the time he enjoys out in nature, waiting for that next chance to put food on his family's table. Rich Egger reporting.
The practice of canning food is not necessarily a necessity anymore. Most fresh fruits and vegetables are available at the grocery store year-round, but over the last few years, home canning has gained popularity. Harvest Public Media's Lily Halloran has this report on the history of canning and how it's making a comeback.
In the 1800s, canning was done in the home, primarily by women. They preserved surplus peas, peaches, corn, and other acidic foods in glass jars, storing them on shelves to eat throughout the year. But the 20th century brought federal food safety regulations, two world wars, and lots of cultural change. Canned goods moved from home kitchens to grocery store shelves as consumers gained confidence in commercial canning.
A simple idea, but one of great promise.
When industrial canning reached its peak in the 1950s, industry leaders were selling it as progress.
We refer to it, and rightly so, as the miracle of the can.
Then the 1960s brought the feminist movement and changed the relationship between women and food preparation. Americans wanted convenience. But now, canning has come home again. People who have the extra time and money are showing off their pantries full of colorful glass jars on Instagram. The hashtag canning has over 960 million views on TikTok.
It's become more of an edutainment for many people.
That's food historian Suzanne Corbett. She says canning has shifted from a vital skill in the kitchen to an at-home hobby.
There's so much fast food and pre-processed food and that have kind of pushed that convenience factor to a situation where our cooking has become performance art in your own home.
People tend to return to canning when things get scary, according to Claire Schmidt, a folklorist at Missouri Valley College. She points to the 2008 recession and the COVID pandemic. For Schmidt's family, 2020 was a time when trips to the grocery store were rare, and they were looking for ways to stay positive.
Okay, your school's closed, and everything is weird, and the radio is talking about people dying. But hey, we've got canned peaches, and so things aren't all that bad.
Americans left lockdown and returned to work. But canning remains popular. In the last year, Jenna Smith taught more food preservation classes than ever before. A nutrition and wellness educator for the Illinois Extension, she says her students arrive with different experience levels. A grandparent may have taught them, or social media, which isn't such a great source, according to Smith.
I just cringe sometimes at some of the videos and things that I see that are just so, you know, not safe.
But no matter what inspired her students, Smith says they're eager to have more control over the food they eat.
You know, actually seeing when you open up your cabinets, all these beautiful jars of preserved foods, that in itself, I think, is such a joy to many people.
Some have scaled up the old school approach to canning. Kansas City Canning Company owner Tim Tuohy and his workers fill glass jars with unique flavors of fruit preserves, pickles, and various vegetables. Tuohy says he started the company with a plan to marry traditional practices with a modern approach. He took inspiration from childhood memories of canning tomatoes with neighbors.
There's a connection to the past that people can actually identify with because it has that nostalgia to it. I think fondly about spending time in the garden with my dad and picking the tomatoes and spending time with Joan and Frank across the street.
Tuohy says he frequently fields questions from customers who want to try their hand at canning. What once seemed like a dying art is alive and well. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Lily Halloran.
That's all the time we have for this episode of Statewide. Thanks for tuning in. And join us next week. We'll be back with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. You can find our show where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.